Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this St. Patrick's Day, the 17th of March. Within 7 weeks of the death of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Jacqueline Kennedy received over 800,000 condolence letters. 2 years later, the volume of correspondence would exceed 1.5 million letters. Our guest this hour has culled 250 of these letters, America's vivid recollections of November 22nd, 1963. Our guest says that what is contained in the book, Letters to Jackie, Condolences from a Grieving Nation, provides an illuminating snapshot of the United States as it existed in 1963 and a rare opportunity to discern how some Americans made sense of a cataclysmic historical event that lingers in our national memory. The coffin was very small, one 16-year-old girl observed, to contain so much of so many Americans. In reflecting on their sense of loss, their fears, and their striving, the authors of these letters wrote an American elegy as poignant and compelling as their shattered and cherished dreams. Joining us this hour is Ellen Fitzpatrick, a professor and scholar who specializes in modern American political and intellectual history. She is a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire, author and editor of 6 books, appears regularly on PBS's The News Hour with Jim Lehrer and other programs as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send us an email, it is talk@wpr.org. Ellen Fitzpatrick, happy St. Patrick's Day, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you with us. I got to tell you, these are hard to read. I was alive during that time. I was probably a couple years older than you were, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. And to read these letters, oh my gosh, they are just so moving. So many of them are so moving. It really collected now. I wish we had had a little bit earlier, but thank goodness you did it now. This national sense, this sense of what so many people were going through from all walks of life.
Yes, I think the letters are tremendously moving, and reading them, as you can imagine, in the quantity that I read them, it was really, an incredible experience. It was a privilege in many ways, but it certainly brings back a lot of the sadness and the heartbreak of that shattering moment in our history.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how many of them were saved, how you got access to these. She received so many letters.
She did. She got about 800,000, as you said, within the first 7 weeks. And she went on the national television at that point to thank the country for those letters and to express her determination to acknowledge each one of them. And she had assistance from volunteers, and over the ensuing next 2 years, really, the volume, as you said, exceeded, probably 1.5 million letters, each one of which was opened and acknowledged by Mrs. Kennedy's staff of secretaries and volunteers who worked on this effort. The letters were then, when the John F. Kennedy Library was formed in the mid-1960s, these letters were turned over to the library, as was Mrs. Kennedy's wish. She wanted subsequent generations to be able to see them so they would know how much her husband had meant to Americans and indeed to the rest of the world. There's a lot of foreign mail that is not in the book. And so they were turned over to the library. The library is part of the National Archives system. And the feeling among the archivists at that point in time, before we have some of the technologies we have today, was that there would be too many to be able to store and handle. So they actually pulped most of the collection, but they saved about 15,000 letters from Americans. There are many, many boxes of foreign mail. There are boxes and boxes of poetry and mass cards and greeting cards. I focused on the 15,000 letters extant from Americans. They're right there in the archives. They're open to researchers. And the Kennedy Library was absolutely wonderful in supporting my research into these letters.
And Ellen, you put it into different categories, the letters that you chose, but I'm wondering what sense you wanted to give us after you sat and read, which must have been quite something, 15,000 letters, you culled 250. Those are to give us what kind of feeling after we've read them?
I wanted, as you know, it was interesting, Kathleen. As soon as I began reading them, I could see the structure of this book. Some of the letters talk about November 22nd, and people talk about where they were when they heard the news, the impact that it had on them. There were people who had greeted the Kennedys that morning at Love Field, had shaken their hands, and only to go back to their car and turn on the radio and hear news of the shooting in Dallas. There were people along the motorcade route. There was a woman standing in Bloomingdale shopping, and she describes the news and all of the shoppers just standing there in stunned silence. And so a lot of letters in the first part of the book focus on that day. The second part of the book collects letters that have something to say about politics, society, and the president. That is, many people reflected on the state of the nation, what they thought the country's problems were, their views of American politics, their sense of Kennedy as president. And then a final set of letters are letters that talk about grief and loss, in which people describe losses they experienced in their own lives in an effort to help Mrs. Kennedy. They're really trying to console her and give her some advice about how, using their own life experience, how they went forward in the face of overwhelming grief and sadness.
And she was the one who gave a lot of those people, although perhaps we didn't realize it at the time, but the way she handled herself, oh my gosh, can you imagine being in a situation like that, Ellen? And the way she, day after day after day, holding together the nation that was just in grief here, in shock, what a job she had. And she taught many, many people about how to handle deep sorrow.
Yes, there's an amazing letter from a woman, a widow, whose husband was a lawyer who had been shot in the head by a disgruntled client, leaving her with four children, I believe. And she describes the overwhelming sense of depression and her inability to really go forward in the face of that, and how this had happened several months before President Kennedy's assassination. And, of course, the assassination, you know, it wasn't hard to stir it up again, but this certainly did. And yet she was very inspired by the example of Mrs. Kennedy, her stoicism and dignity in the midst of this terrible, terrible, ghastly tragedy, pulling herself together and going forward. And this woman is writing to thank her for having given her an example and something to hold on to go forward.
Mm-hmm. And what about the gentleman, I believe it was a heart attack he suffered, at the very moment or close to the very moment that President Kennedy was pronounced dead. Was this in Dallas? Wasn't he in Dallas?
I don't have the letter in front of me. I don't think he was in Dallas, but he was sitting at home. He had come home for lunch. He was sitting with his wife. The wife says, you know, my husband was drinking a glass of milk. It had come on the news. The news had been interrupted that there had been a shooting in Dallas. This man was 42 years old, and he had his last words to her were, "How could someone do something so terrible to our president?" And he had a heart attack, and he died without knowing whether the president lived or not. And in fact, there were, I think I read five letters of people describing a heart attack of a family member in the face of this news. And I chose this one because she, you know, described so vividly what occurred. And her 16-year-old son had been dismissed from school and came home, and so was with her and her husband when his father died.
Mm-hmm. Tell us your memories, too. You had a chance to see, well, we'll talk about the president's visit to your hometown and the dedication of the Robert Frost Library, was that?
Yes. I was 11 years old. I grew up in a college town, Amherst, Massachusetts, and President Kennedy came to Amherst on October 26, 1963, to dedicate the Robert Frost Library at Amherst College. And it was really just a short walk from my home, and there was tremendous excitement in my family. My father was born the same year as President Kennedy. He was a naval officer during the Second World War. My parents had both were Irish Catholic, had come from Massachusetts, and they were roughly the age of, you know, they belonged to the World War II generation, and they greatly admired President Kennedy. So it was a day of great excitement in the Fitzpatrick family, and we all went up to see the president. I went up with a friend of mine, and I did see President Kennedy. It was very thrilling. I'd never seen an American president before. And then less than a month later, I was in the sixth grade, and we were getting a tour of the library. My parents that morning had been talking about the climate of right-wing extremism in Texas and their concerns about this trip to Dallas. So when I heard some teachers talking about there was news that there had been the president had been shot in Dallas, I instantly believed it. I thought that it must be true, and it was, you know, terribly upsetting, of course, mm-hmm. to all of us.
And there was something, without being too sentimental about all of this, but this presidency was incredibly important to many Americans, to minority Americans, but to Irish Catholic Americans, it mm-hmm. was a very big deal, wasn't it? It's true of my family as well. There was great love. I mean, I still have a little drawer that's filled with the Kennedy half dollars that were made into necklaces and that my Aunt Margaret O'Leary wore all the time. There was something, he was held very, very deep to the heart. There was a lot of pride that he had won the presidency.
Absolutely. And we forget, I think today, happily, you know, our society has made great strides in many respects, but the anti-Catholicism that
yes.
was very yeah. apparent. There are many, many letters from people who said, I didn't vote for the guy because he was a Catholic. And there are as many more letters from people who say, I so admired our Catholic president. And there were people who took great pride in the fact that Kennedy had broken through that barrier. It's sort of ironic when you think about the role of Irish Catholics, you know, historically in the Democratic Party from the 19th century forward, really. It was a form of mobility to be involved in politics and you know, the ward bosses, the Democratic political machines in Chicago and New York and other parts of the country, and yet they could never quite get that top prize. And of course, Al Smith's loss in his bid for the presidency. So it was a barrier that Kennedy broke through, and there was a lot of pride in that. And a lot of discomfort, on the other hand, from those who were very worried that his Catholicism, ironically, they were worried that he was going to inject religion into politics. We're now living in a time when religion
exactly.
is very much a part
exactly.
of politics.
Exactly. How true. I never thought of it that way. How true. And it's interesting that all the letters, almost every single letter that you read, not all of them, but the vast, vast majority were extremely respectful. Obviously, there were some people who were writing who hadn't voted for President Kennedy, but there was a great shock about this event and outrage about the event. How could this happen in this country at this time? It had happened before, but how could this happen in our lifetime? This is not my country.
Yes, there was tremendous, you know, this was a horrific, horrific event, and there was terrible, shock among many Americans, and there were people who said, I didn't like the guy, I was looking forward to voting against him again in 1964, but this should never have happened in the United States of America. There's an amazing letter from a man who says, Mrs. Kennedy, I hope you live your loss down. I don't think the country ever will.
Mm. And what do you think about that?
Well, I think that we have moved on from this moment in time, and yet what you see in the letters is an interesting paradox. On the one hand, it feels like a much more innocent time in our history. It's before Vietnam. It's before Watergate. It's a time where there seemed to be greater deference for the president. And on the other hand, it's also the age of segregation, when the civil rights movement is pressing against these terrible inequalities that existed in our society, and President Kennedy introducing the first civil rights legislation reluctantly. He was pressed hard on it and pushed to that point, but he made a very powerful speech in favor of civil rights in June of 63. And so, on the one hand, you can see the progress we've made as a society, and on the other hand, you can also see the way in which, it feels like a more innocent time.
So many of the letters from poor people, sometimes African-American people, express, and the spelling isn't correct here because a lot of these people haven't been to school, but some of these letters, this one's perfectly written, may you always remember, this one's written to Carolyn and Little John, may you always remember history will be filled with the goodness your daddy did, but the poverty-stricken, poor people who survive can tell you better.
Yes, and she signs it, we all loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very moved by that letter. There were many, many letters from poor people of white and black who describe the feeling that they had that here's, John F. Kennedy, one of the wealthiest presidents in American history, and they felt a sense of identification with him.
Yes.
And that he cared about their problems. There are a lot of letters from West Virginians, coal mining families, describing the great interest, the hope that they felt, that he was concerned about the level of poverty in West Virginia and Appalachia, and his interest in helping these folks.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Ellen Fitzpatrick is our guest. She is receiving, and we'll ask her, a lot of people have picked up on this book. It's been receiving a great deal of attention. I was watching NBC one day a couple weeks ago, and they included, we'll ask her what she thought about Jacqueline Kennedy's response to these letters, in which she, 7 weeks after the death of her husband, addressed people and thanked them for all of their condolences. And the book has really taken off. We'll ask her, Ellen what that says about now. The book is Letters to Jackie, Condolences from a Grieving Nation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and some lines are open if you would like to join us. 800-486-8655. Hugh from Milwaukee, our first caller. Hello.
Hi. I would like to bring up something a little different, the reaction to the news where I was. I was young at the time. I had voted for Kennedy in 1960, my first vote for president. And I was teaching fifth graders, 10 to 14-year-olds. And I'd been called to another room to tune in. We were listening to something it's called a transistor radio, one of those new things.
Right.
And we heard something, and I went back to my classroom, and I announced that there's just news over the radio from Dallas that the President Kennedy has been shot. And the kids immediately applauded and cheered. With one exception, one girl put her head down and cried, but all of the others were cheering.
Where were you teaching?
Well, I'm from the South.
Oh.
I was in New Orleans.
Oh.
And I was told that this was a very common reaction in many of the schools throughout the South. And, of course, it's been covered up. The liberal media was liberal back then.
Well, what was your response to that when your students cheered?
Well, I had been arrested in the first sit-in in New Orleans. So, of course, I kept that quiet because I wanted to keep my job. But I gave them a talk. This is for 10-year-olds. But I said, people were very happy with the assassination of President Lincoln. They thought that would be the end of the Yankee dominance and so forth, and that the South would rule again. And I said they were wrong, and said you had radical Reconstruction, which was far more far less to the liking of many Southerners. And I said, you think this is the end of civil rights, and it's not. And I was very unhappy with their reaction.
I would imagine.
This is what's interesting. I think the immediate reaction in many parts of the South was a delight at the murder.
Ellen, would you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that. I don't doubt your caller's account here at all, and there certainly were these kinds of reactions. But I think if you sort of take the larger picture of the response in the nation itself, not just these letters. The letters are significant simply because they're another dimension of what we know to have been a widespread national response to this event. There were many letters and many accounts from Southerners who describe really their, fundamental opposition to President Kennedy, who were nonetheless very stunned and terribly upset by this event. One of the things about the school children account, and clearly your caller's telling a different kind of story, and I'm sure this was not the case in his classroom, but the one thing that came out later was that some of the children who were said to have been applauding were applauding the news that they were going to be let out of school early, and that was later picked up by the media as applauding the murder of the president. So I think, absolutely fair to say that not all Southerners were big fans of President Kennedy. He had his opponents all over the country, although he was actually one of the most popular presidents in the modern era. His popularity ratings were extremely high during his presidency, but he certainly had his opponents, and there was a great deal of opposition to his civil rights policy. So I don't doubt the story. I don't think it was widespread.
No. Thanks to you for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. For those people, those of us who lived through the time know this history from living through it, that we forget that other people don't have the same sense of it. But go back to what your parents were talking about the morning of the assassination, the political climate in Texas and in Dallas that day, why they were worried about, and a lot of people were worried, a lot of Kennedy's advisors told them that don't go to Dallas. Do this setup for us, which you include in the beginning part of your book.
Sure. What was happening in Dallas was that there had been, Adlai Stevenson had been to Dallas to give a speech on United Nations Day. He was ambassador to the UN, and he had come and talked to, he was giving a kind of routine speech, and when he left the hall, he was greeted with some, very, very aggressive demonstrators who were opposed to the United Nations. You have to kind of roll back the clock a little bit on that one, too, that the United Nations, which today, many people see as not effective enough, then was seen as a really problematic by some conservatives, felt that it was a surrender of American sovereignty to even be participating in the UN. So people who opposed the UN, who opposed American foreign policy as not sufficiently aggressive, who thought that Kennedy was, quote, soft on communism, Stevenson was met with these demonstrators, some of whom spat in his face, and he was hit in the head with a picket sign. And it was quite a scene. And so there had also been circulating in Dallas just days before the assassination a handbill that had that depicted a front and side view of President Kennedy as if in a mugshot, and it had the in bold letters above it, "Wanted for treason." And it had a bill of particulars that really described him as being not sufficiently aggressive in dealing with our communist enemies. And the morning of the assassination, the John Birch Society sympathizers had also run a very, you know, sort of bitter advertisement in a Dallas Morning newspaper attacking Kennedy. So this was the political climate that some were concerned about.
If you had been advising him in those years, would you have cautioned him?
Well, he was cautioned. There were, as you pointed out, people who said, don't go to Dallas. But Kennedy, you know, very much liked to interact with crowds. This was a political trip. He was trying to heal over some divisions in the Texas Democratic Party. And in fact, was very aware that his civil rights policy was, as it was emerging, was alienating powerful Southern Democrats, and that he was going to need the state of Texas to win this election in 1964. Just having LBJ on the ticket wasn't going to be enough. So that was his purpose in making that trip. And this, of course, is an event that could have happened anywhere.
Yes, right. Let's go to Sherry from Wausau next. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Thank you for letting me be on and tell my story. I was 15 when it happened, and I remember coming home for lunch, and my mom and dad were glued to the TV, and they said that President Kennedy had been shot. And I wasn't into politics at 15, so I was surprised by my reaction. I immediately started crying. And I ran upstairs because I had a picture of Jesus on my wall, and I begged and prayed that our president would live. Mm. And I had to go back to school. They didn't let us out of school. I couldn't believe it because I couldn't think the rest of the afternoon. But I remember my parents, my dad and brother were pretty stoic, but we never left the TV. We watched everything. We watched the funeral procession. My mother and I cried through everything. And the thing is, I didn't realize how much I loved our president, but I think we all had such a sense that he cared for the middle class and the little guy, and it was in a really an emotional time, and I'll never, ever forget where I was or how that affected me.
Ellen.
That's a very common reaction, what you've just described. There are so many children and even adults who say that when they heard the initial report that he had been shot, that they prayed that he would live. And it's poignant to read these, dashed hopes and, of course, this terrible murder killed the president really instantly, and yet the lag time in the news, there was the initial short report of the shooting and then a half hour or so before he was pronounced dead. And so this is a very, very common response. This was a very traumatic event for Americans who lived through it, and that's why I think these memories are indelibly etched. And you know, anyone who was alive at the time can pretty much tell you where they were and how they experienced it.
Yes, they certainly can. Was it unusual for school to keep going? Were most schools dismissed, do you know, in the country?
I think that varied. I've heard reports either way. But one thing that's poignant, and this in light of your previous caller as well, are the teachers who wrote to Mrs. Kennedy and described their efforts to carry on in their classrooms. They were faced with the really very difficult task of telling sometimes very young children, you know, of grade school kids, that the president had been killed.
Right.
And they made up, sort of exercises to there's a wonderful letter from a woman in the state of Washington describing how she had a group of what she called Dick and Janers. They were elementary school children, and she got them to take out their crayons and paper, and they wrote, "The president has been, the president has died, our flag is at half-mast." And she describes, you know, in detail how she broke the news, how she tried to help these children, and their response to the event. The response of children to this event is well documented in the collection and is really one of the striking elements of the story.
Yes, it is. And then she, our caller talked about that nonstop television viewing.
Yes.
And then, you know, I remember our family on its way to church, and there Lee Harvey Oswald gets shot by Ruby on live television. I don't remember going to church that day. I think we must have just stayed home and continued watching television. That was a pretty dramatic day as well.
Yes, I think it's the first televised, you know, murder in real time ever. You know, television was a relatively young medium at that time, and this was the first event that got this kind of round-the-clock coverage. And I think the estimates are that somewhere in the vicinity of 98% of Americans watched some portion of that coverage over those 4 days when the president's lying in state and then state funeral were televised.
Let's go to an email. And thank you very much for your call. We got an email from Jim from Madison. Surely it hearkens to an America where the humanity of its ordinary people was clearly on display. I like that phrase. It's true. The sweetness of ordinary Americans was spontaneous and free-flowing. Sadly, that enduring trait is no longer on display in American life anymore. Sure, there were ugly aspects in America, but what I would give to see that endearing part of America again. We have become spoiled and full of ourselves.
Well, I have to say that I was, if there was one element of this project that, you know, as a person, as well as a historian, touched me the most, it was the incredible compassion and decency of these folks who wrote to Mrs. Kennedy.
Yes,
and
yes.
People with very little often in their lives. I mean, some of these people were writing on scraps of paper. They were barely literate. And yet, they talked about their aspirations for the country. They talked about their patriotism. They talked about their dreams. And they talked about their sense of President Kennedy as somebody who had given them a sense of hope for their own future. And that's extremely compelling to see the affection and faith that these Americans had in their president. You know, historians may debate how well placed that was in any given president, Kennedy or anyone else, but it was very, very evident in that day, and I do think that that is a relic of a bygone era.
And you talk in the book about the fact that all the intimate details of a president's life, which are now the subject of a lot of media attention, weren't, that it was off limits, that the press knew that you didn't ask about maybe an affair. There had been a rumored affair. We subsequently learned, and there were many books written about Kennedy's behavior and his sickness, et cetera. Were we better off, and did it, I don't know, influence our idealism to not know all of this about him? Were we naive in a way because of, or were we better off because we didn't have all those details?
Well, I tend to think, you know, in a democracy that more information is good. You know, the American people under our democratic system have a weighty responsibility. We are, you know, we are in a political system that is supposed to be governed by the will of the people. So you want the people to be well informed. But one wonders, really, I think what's disturbing in our current political climate is the way in which these human dimensions, the failings, personality traits, become so magnified and so much a focus of attention that the issues, the substance, the information that we really need to make decisions about American political life and the direction of the nation get too little attention. So paradoxically, we have the capacity to know more than ever before, and yet the focus of our curiosity and inquiry, one might argue, is too often on the wrong things.
Hmm. Let's go to Ron from La Crosse next. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I'm old enough to remember that assassination, and I do, of course, I was attending a Catholic parochial school, and I do remember, you know, some people cried and everything. Everybody, it was a combination of shock and then sort of a resignation. Well, these things happen. I'm a history buff, and according to what I know about Kennedy's last days as president, he had made a decision on Vietnam not to send any more Americans over there. Not only that, he was going to withdraw all Americans, which is to say not only military advisors but all the CIA people. And if he had lived, we probably would have not going to come embroiled in the Vietnam War if he had been reelected.
What's your take on that, Ellen?
Well, there's a lively historical debate on that question, and there are many books written by historians on both sides of the question. Unfortunately, it's in the nature of this whole situation that we will never know what the rest of John F. Kennedy's presidency would have been like had he lived. It is the case that President Kennedy was a World War II veteran, and he had a very keen understanding, and some of it hard won through his own mistakes in his own administration, the Bay of Pigs invasion and so forth. He had become more jaundiced over his brief period as president about the some of the advice that he had been given by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he was cautious on the idea of intervention, but he was also very much a cold warrior, and I think historians correctly note that there was a kind of hubris in many foreign policymakers of the time in believing that it would be easier to build a nation and to try to address concerns about the spread of communism in that way. So nation building in Vietnam and elsewhere was very much a project of Kennedy and others of the Cold War era. So it's very hard to say. There's a debate about it. There's a lot written about it. I don't think we know.
Yeah. When the caller talked about some people saying, well, these things happen, I think most of the letters keep asking why,
yes.
How could this happen? These things don't normally happen.
Yes.
This is beyond the pale.
Yes, I think that very much the theme in the letters is of utter shock. That there's one letter from a young man who says, presidents are not assassinated in the United States of America. Well, of course, there had been three previous presidential assassinations, but not since the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that, you know, in our modern, forward-moving country in the 1960s that this would happen, I mean, it was utterly beyond belief to the vast majority of Americans.
Mm-hmm. What was it like? I know on your book tour, I believe you were at the school depository building, weren't
yes.
you? The museum now. What was that like to be talking about these letters in that place?
It was very fascinating to me, and I was welcomed very warmly by many folks in Dallas. There was a good turnout at the sixth-floor museum. The Texas Book Depository is now a museum, and a very fine one at that. And it was fascinating in my time in Dallas how many adults had stories to tell about that day and their connection to it. It was eerie to be in the spot, having written this book and having never been to Dallas before, and to actually see the site of the Kennedy assassination. I was very I would say that physically, geographically, it seemed less than the sum of its parts to think that only, you know, they were just seconds away from being under this underpass where they would have been out of range. And to think about all the history that has unfolded since that time and that it was a matter of seconds that made the difference in this, I suppose one could argue that it might have happened elsewhere, but it was quite shocking to me, actually, to see how small, really, the area was geographically. Somehow, in my mind, having seen footage of the site, I thought of it as more elongated than it was. So, in terms of the response, though, from people in Texas who came to these events, very great interest in these letters, and also many people talked about the burden that they felt, which is documented amply in the letters, in which they felt that they were being blamed by the rest of the country for the assassination. And there were several people who told me that they didn't want to tell people where they were from because they felt ashamed or that they would be criticized or shunned because they were from Dallas. And so I think there's a kind of burden that many people bore that they spoke of to me directly on that trip.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Ellen Fitzpatrick. Letters to Jackie, her book, Condolences from a Grieving Nation. It's about 250 of the letters that were sent to, among 1.5 million letters sent to Jacqueline Kennedy after the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And we're talking about the substance of them and welcoming your calls. We'll be back to you momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to Camille now from Frankfurt. Hi, Camille.
Hello. The assassination occurred on my 8th birthday, and the year before we had taken a family vacation to Washington, D.C. So this was a very significant thing for me, and it's kind of been, it's repeated itself, obviously, you know, as I was growing up and on the anniversaries. So there are two things that I want to say. The first point is that I think that when people say things like, oh, this can't happen here and how can this happen, I have felt that what's really going on with people, what was going on with people then, on a less than conscious level, was that I think they were sensing or shocked into a realization that times were changing, that something was changing that would not be the same again. Not just the assassination of a president, but something greater than that. And the second point I want to make is that because of the way times have changed, and especially the comment that someone made about what she wouldn't give for that innocence again, when the 25th anniversary occurred, I was writing articles then, and I wrote one about us taking our grief out every year, every so often, and feeling all that again. And what I wrote about was that what Kennedy stood for was much greater than one man should be responsible for holding, and that if we really looked at why we loved him so much, we need to bring those ideals into our own lives, one person at a time. And when I was kind of afraid when I wrote it that, you know, I would get some cynical answers and things like that, but I really got a lot of positive response from people younger than me. And so I just wanted to share those couple of points, and I would really love if the guest could possibly read one of the letters before the show is over.
Yes, we will have her do that. Oh, that must be something to have be your eighth birthday on that day, and others did as well. Ellen, your response.
What a wonderful comment that is on so many levels. There are several things I'd like to say in response. First, there were many letters from parents whose children had been born on November 22nd. There were, in fact, babies born on November 22nd, and some of whom were named after the president and Mrs. Kennedy. There, I think I read letters from parents of several sets of twins who were named after both of them, in fact. And there's a photograph in the book of two children named after them who weren't born on November 22nd. But the birthday theme was there. There was a letter from a mother who talked about her baking the cake for her son and just not having her heart in it and how badly she felt that there was the coincidence of these two events. There's also a letter in the book from a man who had lived through the assassinations of all four presidents. He was 99 years old, and he wrote to Mrs. Kennedy and said that it had been his misfortune to have seen, lived through all four assassinations, and his birthday was on November 22nd. The second thing is the sense of the caller raised, this issue of the sense of it not being able to, it can't happen here, and that, and in fact, that this was a foreshadowing. I think there's a lot of truth to that because there were many letters, and this should be underscored, from people who felt that the climate of violence, there was a climate of violence in the United States. Remember, this is the time I had mentioned the civil rights movement. In the spring, there had been the Birmingham campaign, and when fire hoses and dogs had been turned on civil rights demonstrators, the bombing of the church when the little school children, the small children were killed, the violence that had come along with the resistance to desegregation was very much a part of the landscape. And a lot of people wrote and said that this had contributed, they felt, to emboldening a madman to attack the president. And that was a very powerful and often heard theme in these letters. So I think that the caller raises a very important point.
Right.
And finally, her point about the burden that this would be carried by one man, all of these hopes and aspirations. There are many letter writers who said, if we can take anything away from this, let it be a testimony to President Kennedy, a testament to his impact on us, that you know, we rededicate ourselves to these ideals, and that the best thing we can do is to carry forward these principles that we believe he stood for.
Could you read, we're short on time, I want to take at least one more phone call. Could you pick one of the shorter letters that you found, well, there are many of them, but there one you'd like to read to us?
I have a letter that I find in many ways, I think, captures all of the themes, the eloquence of ordinary people, as well as the sense of what we should take away from it. Dear Mrs. Kennedy, I wish to extend to you and the children my condolences. Children increase the cares of life, but they do help to mitigate the remembrance of death. We are told that a good key is necessary to enter paradise. The president, following the guidelines of his church, possessed this key. Heaven, it seems, calls its favorites early. In the president, I felt that I had known a whole man. It is a rare experience, but always an illuminating and ennobling one. It costs so much to be a full human being that there are very few who have the enlightenment or the courage to pay the price. The lights of the prison have gone out now. In this, the quiet time, I can't help but feel that my thoughts and the thoughts of my countrymen will ever reach out to that light on an Arlington hillside for sustenance. How far that little light throws his beam. Sincerely, Stephen J. Hanrahan, 85255, Federal Penitentiary, Atlanta, Georgia.
Ooh, yeah, you got us on that one. You also traced, which was a lot of work, what happened to a lot of these people who wrote the letters?
Yes, that was a virtue imposed by necessity. That is, although these letters are in the National Archives, the copyright under U.S. copyright law still is retained by the letter writer or his or her heirs. And so we needed to find the letter writers or a family member in order to gain permission to publish an entire letter. And so that sent me on a hunt to find the people.
Quite a hunt.
Oh, it was an amazing experience, and really one of the most rewarding of my entire career as a historian.
Yeah, Ellen, thank you so much for being with us. The book has really captivated a lot of people, and rightfully so. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Ellen Fitzpatrick, the book is Letters to Jackie, Condolences from a Grieving Nation, and we thank her for her time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, Chrissy Pease for producing this program, and thanks for your calls, everybody. Be with you again tomorrow. Happy St. Patrick's Day. This is the Ideas Network.